Case number 15-5239, Washington Alliance of Technology Workers Appellant versus United States Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Miano for the appellant, Mr. Fresco for the affilee.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Miano for the Washington Alliance of Technology Workers, and with me is Dale Wilcox at the table. May it please the court. The central issue in this case, Your Honor, is whether the Department of Homeland Security has the authority to transform student visas into a guest worker program designed to supply labor to industry. If we go straight to the statute.
What about the jurisdictional issue? Yeah.
I will be happy to answer do you have any questions, Your Honor, about jurisdiction?
Well, our precedent for many years suggests that district court orders remanding to agencies are not final or otherwise reviewable in this posture, I believe. And we can question where that precedent came from, but it's there, right? So what's your response to all that?
My response here, this is what the district court said to the order. The court will last until February the 12th, 2016, during which time DHS can submit the 2008 rule for proper notice and comment. DHS apparently has determined that they're not submitting the 2008 rule for notice and comment. Okay, so there will never be any subsequent rulemaking that arises out of this order.
They've gone with a new approach entirely, right?
I don't understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, keep going.
Okay. The problem here, I think the court has created kind of an unusual remedy here in between. In the past, where there has been a remand, the court has said you will report back after a certain period of time. You're to do a specific thing. Here, the court has used the term remand, and I think maybe the court has used it without a lot of precision. That in other cases for example, the Hawaiian long lines, the court...
Well, remand is a term we use a lot, too, where someone brings a challenge to an agency rule, and we agree that there's some problem of some kind or another with the agency rule, but we're not going to vacate the effectiveness of the agency rule. Instead, we're going to send it back to the agency for a fix or a do-over or what have you. But in the meantime, the rule will continue in effect. And when district courts do that, we've said we're not going to review it until it comes back, and then we look at the whole thing because it may never come back. It's a rule of judicial efficiency, arguably.
Well, I absolutely understand, Senior. The problem is, normally, when a district court makes a remand, they tell the agency to do something. Okay. Here, the district court has not told the agency to do anything at all.
I mean, isn't that implied? District court didn't send it back for no reason, for nothing to happen.
Well,
we do know what happened.
We do know what happened, Your Honor. What happened subsequently is DHS created a new rule separate from this, and the order doesn't say DHS can create a new rule. It doesn't mention a new rule at all, but it doesn't prohibit DHS from doing a new rule. But they did it.
Why wouldn't the new rule then alternatively moot the case that you've brought before us? Your complaint is all about, put aside the statute of limitations issues with the 1992 regulation. It's all about attack on 2008 and 2011, 2012, all of which are, or at least is within a week, will be gone.
Judge Miller, that's not the case because the complaint attacks the entire policy of allowing aliens to work on student visas when they're not students. And when a complaint attacks a policy, a subsequent rulemaking does not moot the case.
But the whole basis for deciding that your challenge to the policy, you'd have to challenge the current regulation, and we'd have to decide the lawfulness of that policy on the basis of administrative record that we don't have before us.
Well, Your Honor, for example, here, under the 1992 regulations, which we challenged, those regulations are still in effect. The work authorization under the 2000 and under the 1992 regulations remains in effect today. So there's
right, but those were barred by the statute of limitations.
But not, Your Honor, but not for being in excess of authority under the reopener doctrine.
Well, what are you saying reopened here, the 2008 rule or the 2016 forthcoming rule? Which one is the reopening?
We have argued that by it is well established that if a plaintiff challenges both a specific agency action and the where an agency reiterates a policy in such a way as to render the policy subject to a new challenge on any substantive grounds.
I get what the reopener doctrine is. Asking you which action you think is doing the reopening, the 2008 rule or the forthcoming 2016 rule?
The 2008 rule, Your Honor, reopened the 1992 regulations.
Whether it reopened or not, it will disappear into the vapor, so there will be nothing to challenge through. There will be no 2008 rule to challenge as a reopening even of the 1992 issue.
Your Honor, but the 1992 rule is still under, the work authorization of the 1992 rule is still under
fact. Which is barred by the statute of limitations.
Which
it's
was
not,
reopened by the by reopen, the...
It can't be reopened by a regulation that doesn't exist.
Well, it exists right now, Your Honor.
Okay. If we don't issue an opinion by May 10th, what happens to your reopener argument then?
It's, again, doesn't say that. I've never seen that when something is reopened again, that a subsequent new rule moots the reopening later on. Because if that's the case, this could be going on forever and ever and ever, because we could challenge the new rule. DHS could put out a new rule on appeal. This is an action that's
can
capable.
Can you seek a stay of the new rule? Can you seek a stay of the new rule?
Your Honor, but then you would have to show irreparable harm to get a stay of the new rule, which is very high standard, and our experience has been in the court that the district courts did not grant them here for this kind of thing.
Isn't there a separate jurisdictional problem here in that there's still a claim to be ruled upon by the district court, which is the arbitrary and capricious claim?
Judge Wilkins, I don't. My understanding from the opinion is that there's no intention of the court to rule on that. I think it's typical that once the courts reach an outcome on a certain count that's going to decide the outcome. So, for example, here the court decided that the rule was made arbitrary and was made without notice and comment, which normally requires a vacatur of the rule, which is the highest standard, that ruling on arbitrary and capriciousness doesn't get us any farther. So we've already reached the end state with the notice and comment.
Well, you can't. Go ahead.
That, I don't follow that argument because the agency could have simply reissued the exact same rule as it did in 2008, but this time after having notice and comment. And then you'd be back before the district court. And even though you had lost on your other challenges, your Chevron, et cetera, challenges, you would still have before the district court pending the arbitrary and capricious count. And the district court would have an obligation to adjudicate that count one way or the other before there would be a final judgment that could come to us.
That's correct, but in this case, that happening is not going to occur. The DHS, Your Honor, has said is not going to submit this rule for notice and comment.
Well, you could still challenge the 2016 rule in the district court on an arbitrary and capricious basis, right? Even if we assume that the district court would uphold the 2016 rule on Chevron and all the other grounds, you still have a live count in your complaint with respect to the arbitrary and capricious argument, right?
Judge Wilkins, I disagree because I think that the new 2016 rules is a new lawsuit. But there's nothing.
Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell us that the 2008 case is still open for purposes of reopener doctrine for bringing forward your 1992 argument, that it's still a live case there, but that it's actually moot. The 2008 rule doesn't exist for purposes of arbitrary and capricious challenges.
Our argument is that the 2008 rule reopened judgment on the 1992 rule that was made, you know, for various reasons, including reiterating the previous policy, because the 1992 rules were not made with notice and comment, and the issues are inseparable. So they've been reopened, okay? Now that they're reopened, it sounds like you're saying, Your Honor, that once they put a new rule in place, now they're closed, and the reopener doesn't stay in place.
I thought you were saying that the reopener doctrine was keeping alive your challenge to this policy through the 2008 rule. The 2008 rule is the vehicle for challenging the 1992 policy, which is otherwise barred by the statute of limitations. Is that correct, my understanding?
No, Your Honor. I'm going to read in the complaint, the first three counts of the complaint address the policy.
Reopener doesn't mean that we go, okay, here's a new rule. Now we'll ignore that 2008 rule, and we'll actually go back and look at everything as if it was 1992. You look at it through the new rule that did the reopening. So you have to look at the policy through either the 2008 rulemaking or 2016. And you said not 2016. And if you mean 2008, then you must think you have live claims.
Yes, Your Honor. We think we have live claims under the
two. But then you're giving up. You don't have an arbitrary and capricious challenge as well through that same theory?
We have, Your Honor, but it doesn't get us anywhere with the arbitrary and capricious claim, because the district court has already said that it was made without notice and comment, and without notice and comment, which means the rule would be vacated. The district courts were to say that the 2008 rule is arbitrary and capricious as well, then the best that could happen is that they could be vacated, which is the same thing, Your Honor.
Did you move for entry of a final judgment in the district? There's no entry of a final judgment by the district court.
No, we did not make a motion for final judgment.
Because what you granted was a partial summary judgment, granted in part, denied in part.
Yeah, but it granted on both sides, and the only ones it didn't deal with were issues that essentially, I think, would be considered redundant.
Well,
go ahead.
I don't believe that the doctrine says that if you bring a 9-count complaint and there's no judgment on 2 of the counts, that we just kind of ignore that and consider it to be a final judgment. We need to see a judgment entered in the district court as to all 9 counts. I mean, can you direct me as to why that understanding is wrong?
Your Honor, if that is your assertion of the law, then I have to accept your statement of the law. What I would then ask, you know, if you think there's a jurisdictional issue, what gets us to a final judgment in this case? At the time the appeal was filed, case is marked closed in the ECF system. There's no provisions for future events in the opinion. It looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and walks like a duck here.
Sorry, you said is there an entry in the docket that says it's closed? Because I did not see that in the docket, but if I've missed it.
If you go into the ECF system, it says case closed, and it said that when we filed the appeal.
You wanted to say a couple things on the merits. We'll give you time for rebuttal, okay. But do you want to say a couple things on the merits?
I'll try. I'll try to keep it short. I mean, the issue here, is whether the Department of Homeland Security has the authority to transform the student visas into a guest worker program. That under the statute, student visa status is defined as a bona fide student solely pursuing a course of study at an approved academic institution that will report termination of attendance. So that's clearly someone attending school. However, the regulations issue allow people to remain on student visas for years after graduation and then work provide their labor for the very purpose of providing labor to industry, which is incompatible with being a student. What I briefly would say is the implications of this, okay, under the district court's holding that the student visa status, the definition of student visa status is ambiguous, that it could be interpreted as just an entry requirement where the agency is free to do what it wants once the alien gets here. Under that interpretation, every single protection for American workers in the entire immigration system can be wiped out through regulation. DHS can simply say, come here on a tourist visa and work. Plus, it creates the absurd situation where we have Congress and DHS legislating across purposes, that Congress has said that has created a visa category for this very type of labor, put specific limits on the numbers of workers, created an additional category of quota for foreign students, and then DHS says, oh, we don't like what Congress did, so we're going to circumvent that.
Okay. We'll hear from opposing counsel, and we'll give you time back for rebuttal.
It would be possible to make one other, other issue. I know we're going over time, and I'll try to be. And one of the, I would like to briefly explain how these regulations work, and this is related to the reopener doctrine. And the way the system works is under the 1992 regulations, the alien can work for 1 year, okay? The 2008 regulations extended that so that the alien could work for up to about 35 months, depends on certain circumstances. So the 1992 regulations are in effect to this day. The work authorization for the 1992 regulations is in effect to this day and will continue under the new regulations. So the district court said there was no standing to challenge the entire policy of aliens working on student visas. And the effect of that is that we don't have standing to challenge the first year that the alien works on the student visa, but we do have standing to challenge the second and third years, which doesn't make any sense because the injury is absolutely identical.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Leon Fresco from the Department of Justice. I have my colleagues Glenn Gertery and Erez Raveni with me today. Your Honor, while we're certainly happy to discuss any part of the merits of this case, I think at this point we'd like to begin by saying that this lawsuit is no longer viable.
And when can they challenge?
Well, I think, Your Honor, now the...
What they see as a flagrantly unlawful program.
Yes, Your Honor. I think as my brother counsel just indicated, when he talked about finding irreparable harm, he's going to need to find individuals in the United States who he claims are harmed by the 2016 rule, which he's going to sue about regardless of what would happen in this litigation. If this court were to say that the 2008 rule was perfectly fine, he's still going to file a lawsuit anyway under the 2016 rule. That lawsuit is inevitable. So he would find American workers who he claims have been harmed by the 2016 rule, and he would file that lawsuit, and he could argue again. He could argue, even though the 2008 rule certainly didn't reopen the 1992 rule, he could argue it again.
What is the status of the 2008 rule?
The 2008 rule will be gone in its entirety in 6 days on May 10th, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's complete. It has no effect at all.
It has no effect. It's been replaced by an entirely new program, and that entirely new program.
And they can seek a stay or injunction temporary.
They could file that right now, and they've had, as my brother counsel said, they've done that in the past. But they're going to need to find, and which we don't think they found in the prior case, but in their subsequent case, an American worker who they claim will actually be harmed by this 2016 rule. That's what they'd have to do. And this 2016 rule is a substantive.
Well, any American worker who would have been a competitor for one of these jobs will be harmed.
Well. This would clearly be an issue for adjudication, Your Honor.
Sure. Competitor standing, though, is pretty well established.
Well, I think, Your Honor, again, if we want to get into the standing question in this case, which is up to you.
Let's stick with the finality.
But the point is they can file that lawsuit, certainly, and they could argue the same. They could say, just like they claimed that the 2008 law reopened 1992, they could make that same claim about the 2016 rule that it reopened.
I mean, they're frustrated, understandably, because they keep challenging something and it feels like they prevailed, and then, but they didn't really prevail.
Well, Your Honor, they only prevailed on the notice and comment part. They didn't prevail on...
Well, only. I mean, that the agency violated the law on how they promulgated.
Well, yes, Your Honor. And so if one could look at that on either side of the coin, they prevailed. The 2008 rule that they detested no longer existed. So there's no point in continuing with this litigation because that rule no longer exists. Now...
It's replaced by a rule that, from their perspective, is worse. But I guess, I mean, that's for future litigation.
Well, yes, Your Honor. Not only is it for future litigation, but it is, just for the court's understanding, it is a substantively different rule. The employers now have to basically turn into educators and have to have an educational plan in place before one of these OPT extensions is going to be approved. So they have to have, it's kind of like, you know, the whole law firm summer internship type thing, but even more than that, where they sort of say, we're going to give you an, or I would guess the best example would be like a judicial clerkship in a sense, where you're an employer and an educator. And that's what's going to have to happen.
In the clerks rules. Aren't students.
Well, they're not students, but it's certainly a vital part of their... one would say that in the law, that's recognized.
I mean, this is in the merits, but the word in the statute, student, to call people who are working full-time jobs students is...
Well, there are
of the language.
Well, there are many, Your Honor, there are many placements within this OPT. There are research grants. So, for instance, I finish my degree at, let's say, Stanford, and it's a science degree, and they say, okay, now we're going to give you a position at Stanford to conduct research on this very thesis that you've done. And that is a quasi-student type of...
That's not the situation they're complaining about. What they're complaining about is... people who have graduated from school or finished their coursework who are allowed to stay in the United States for up to 3 years and replace American workers for these jobs as an end run around the H-1 visa category, which is capped by Congress at 65,000. And this is an end run by the executive branch because the executive branch, under multiple administrations, doesn't like the H-1 cap because it limits the number of foreign workers, nor does Silicon Valley like the H-1 cap.
That's certainly their complaint, Your Honor, and my only response, obviously we know about the justiciability issues, but my only response substantively would be that the H-1B as it exists today was invented in 1990, and the ability for students to do what you have said is an end run around the statute has existed since 1947. Students have been able since 1947, after they graduate, to obtain employment related to their field.
Silicon Valley complained about the limits on this in the 2000s, right, on the H-1, and proposed to the prior administration just expand this F-1 and just call them all students and keep them here for 3 years.
I would say that description is a partial description of what happened. It wasn't just Silicon Valley. It was the universities. It was members of Congress.
I know.
It was many states. So sort of there was this rendition in the papers.
At least
there was
according to the record, it came out of a Microsoft dinner.
Right. And that Microsoft dinner was in 2007. Just as an example, if you wanted to search, you could find op-eds in the Minneapolis Tribune or whatever the paper is in 2005. We should let students work for long. You know, you could go to Congressional Research Service papers from the early 2000s that talk about we should let students work for longer in the OPT status, which one shows that Congress knows about this because these are in congressional research.
Well, Congress knows about it. Have they ever approved this? Has the administration or the prior administration ever proposed this?
I think the 1990 statute, which said and authorized people to work off campus, not in a part of their field, of their major, was clearly tailoring legislation around the fact that they knew there was a reg available that allowed for practical training for education geared toward their major. That's why it was drafted that way. It wouldn't make any sense to create only educational opportunities for students that were not related to their major. That would be a very bizarre statute to pass.
Why confine it to the STEM category? If this really is because we want people to be able to have that hands-on learning experience, why wouldn't it apply to teachers who need to be teachers' aides?
Why confine the reg to the STEM category, Your Honor? Yeah, because I think it is an important point to say that, as Judge Kavanaugh recognized, this is not a limitless, boundless statute that allows people to work for all people for all purposes. There's something unique about the STEM fields that require more of an ability to get practical training. You know, it's one thing to say, I'm learning about...
Did the agency find that teachers don't actually need to be teacher's aides in the classrooms?
So the 2016 rule goes through all of this and says, here are the nature, the lengths of grants that happen for scientific research.
I'm not disputing that you have a theory for that category. What I'm trying to understand is why, if this really is all about education, where the agency found in the past, or you can tell me, look at 2016 if you want, that outside the STEM category, that's utterly irrelevant and there is no such hands-on learning opportunity.
Well, no, there's 12 months right now for everybody. So if your major was in sociology, you can do 12 months of sociology.
Well, why don't sociologists or teachers in training need 24 months or 48 months?
I think that was just a policy choice, Your Honor, that the agency made.
Was it a pedagogically grounded policy choice or the demand from the employers?
Again, that's not discussed in the 2008 rule. It's discussed in the 2016 rule about the tethering of the length of time to the tasks that are needed to perform to get the practical experience that you would get under your educational background. So I take Your Honor's point that that's not discussed in the 2008 rule, but that doesn't make the 2008 rule illegal in the end, because the question that would be asked under the 2008 rule would be, is the experience that's being given to these people who are graduating from school furthering their pedagogical training? And I believe it certainly is in that
situation. Graduated, not graduating.
Well, no, they graduated, Your Honor, but they are obtaining an experience.
They're still called students.
Well, they are the, if we want to take a look at what that category is in A15, that category, when you look at it tied to 1184, 8 U.S.C. 1184, it's a requirement that's telling an adjudicator at a consulate abroad or here at the border, this is the category of person it has to be to grant them a visa. But this is a critical point, Your Honor.
Now, I understand to get the visa originally.
Yes, but that's what it is, because in A15, the student visa, it actually says who seeks to enter. If it says those words seeks to enter, wouldn't make any sense if this wasn't an adjudicatory requirement.
Couldn't
they
just stay forever then?
Well, no, Your Honor, they can't stay forever. I think the terms of...
Couldn't the agency allow them to stay forever by a new regulation?
So
under that interesting statutory interpretation.
Well, the AUSC 1184 gives the secretary broad authority to set the time and conditions for a visa. But I think there certainly can be a point that the times and conditions could become so untethered so we're not going to say you could stay for 80 years and do whatever you want, but here's a key point. And actually, the analogy my brother counsel made was the perfect analogy. He said, could they just let visitors work? And in fact, Congress actually spoke about this in the B visa. It says you cannot be a visitor here who's performing skilled or unskilled labor. They wrote that in the statute because they didn't want someone who was coming on a visitor visa to perform skilled or unskilled labor. That provision is not in the F visa. And if you go, which is the student visa.
If it's just an entry requirement, why does the statute also require the schools to report? Or a new rule, even the employers report, if someone stops working or stops going to school.
What the requirement is that you cannot get that visa, Your Honor, if you're not attending a school that does this.
No, but once you're in and attending, there's an obligation under the statute to report if someone stops attending, is there not?
Yes, but that's not in A15F. A15F says, we will not grant you a visa unless it's to attend a school that does this reporting. It's a separate statute that talks about the reporting requirements that are done, what the school has to follow, and that statute was enacted in 2002.
Why is that there if it's just an entry requirement?
Well, no, the entry requirement, because that's not an entry requirement, the entry requirement is that a student visa will not be granted if
that,
it's not for a school.
Why do we care if they stopped attending school once they're in? As long as they came in planning to go to school and then dropped out after 6 months, their visa would seem to still be perfectly valid. So what's the point of the report?
Congress has made the choice that if you are not going to be attending school and you are, basically, what Congress has made the choice, actually, is that the school has to monitor the attendance of that student to determine if the student is attending school or not. And that was for safety purposes. That was not for, this was done after 9/11, post-2001, because people were worried about people entering here on student visas and committing terrorist acts. It had nothing to do with fear of workforce situations. That was why that was done, Your Honor.
Are they still obligated to report when these folks graduate, even though they're going off to work in jobs?
So when these folks graduate, they are still in the CVIS system, which is the Student Exchange Visitor Information System, but now the student is interfacing with the CVIS system rather than interfacing with the school.
Okay, my question, though, is does the school have to then report this person's graduated and is no longer attending?
The school places on the CVIS system a notation that the student graduated, and then the student would interface with the CVIS system, not through the school when they're on this OPT. But I think the 2016 rule actually addresses that issue as well, Your Honor. And so that would be another thing that would get, if the court is interested in it, it would again be more appropriately adjudicated to the 2016 rule. And, you know, there actually are the cases from this court that talk about when a new rule is in place, we prefer to adjudicate under the new rule as opposed to under a rule that no longer exists. And more importantly, that we need to find people that actually show harm from the new rule. We just can't presume that this new rules are. And we shouldn't presume it here, because this new rule is actually going to place a lot of burdens on employers that maybe the employers won't want to use. Maybe the employers won't want to use this new rule, as a matter of fact. And so that might mean that there's no harm for the American workers as part of this rule.
No. Their positions that are going to be filled by people on the student visas, and if those positions were otherwise filled, they'd have to be filled by U.S. citizens.
Well, that presupposes, again,
correct,
that
unless they don't fill the position.
I think that presupposes that there are people here who can fill those positions.
You know, if they don't want.
And sometimes there really are not, Your Honor. I mean, this was sort of my whole experience prior to being in the Department of Justice is in the policymaking realm. And there are really not sometimes this fit. And I think one of the key standing difficulties that was in this case is that unlike bricklayers or unlike goat herders, where there's a one-for-one replacement, all the plaintiffs ever did was show us ads that said, well, if you're on OPT, you can apply for our company, but they didn't actually show that there was an increase in OPT programmers. All of these OPT folks could have been physicists, could have been engineers, could have been designers, could have been a lot of things. And if you don't actually show that there's an actual human being on this, or even one, show me that there's one human being that's a programmer that's added to your competition. They never did it here, and the court below never said that. And so I always say as an analogy, this would be like if I said I wanted to play football for the Dallas Cowboys and they hired athletes under the athlete visa to be figure skaters in the halftime show.
Would they be
show.
Injured if you the know. Company put out an ad saying we have openings for computer programmers? We'd like an OPT applicant. No U.S. citizens need apply.
Well,
would they be injured, or would they have to? Is that an injury?
I think first of all, that company's is committing an employment law violation.
Here's my question.
Right.
Would they be injured by
that? And I would say, again, no, Your Honor, unless they prove there's actually an OPT person that exists.
No
that can
U.S. citizens need apply, and that's not an injury.
Well, first of all, that's an illegal act. So we always talk about
standing. I'm not asking about his lawfulness. Well, I'm asking about whether there's a standing injury. This person's qualified for that job.
Right, but the reg doesn't permit that conduct. The reg does not permit an employer to do.
I'm asking whether that would be an Article 3 injury.
No, because the reg doesn't. Here's why, Your Honor. It's an Article 3 injury if the reg had said an employer could do that. Of course, then yes, it's an article. But if the reg doesn't say that an employer can do that, that's just there's tons of case law in this circuit about actions of third parties that are illegal don't create standing. That's what you've just described. You've described a third party act that's illegal. That's not what creates the standing. What creates standing is if the rule itself is increasing the pool of competition. And what I'm saying
is, they showed us an ad here that said only OPT applicants.
Right, but the ad just...
Was that illegal?
To give an extreme, it's illegal, but it's an illegal act of a third party. It's not being done under the rule.
Did you guys do something to the company that did that advertisement?
Well, I have constantly communicated with the Office of Special Counsel, who does this at DOJ, as you know, but I can't do anything more than that. I mean, I pass them emails along all the time about companies who do that, but that's their role. That's not... My role is to defend the immigration litigation that's in the federal courts, Your Honor. But let me say that, you know, to take an extreme example of this question, the ad could say we're only looking for people who visited Mars. The ad can say that. That doesn't mean there are people who can fill that criteria. And that's the point here. All they've shown are ads. They haven't shown that the OPT program created one additional programmer. That just assumed all okay. through the litigation, but that's not fair. But anyway, the key point is we don't have a live case now, Your Honor. That's, to get back to the beginning, and I'm sorry we've gone through this digression. That was fascinating. But the point is the 2008 rule is moot. There's nothing more to decide. They've gotten what they've wanted. They're victorious. Now there's a 2016 rule, which is substantively different and should be challenged in the court, Your Honor.
One last question. Yes. Is OLC ever passed on this?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Why, before you sit down.
But that doesn't mean it hasn't. I just don't know. I just don't know. Yeah.
Why is the 2008 rule actually in effect? Because, in other words, what if the district court didn't have jurisdiction to extend its stay of the 2008 rule?
Right. If the court had said, we're either I'm not going to do it or I don't have jurisdiction to do it, we would have had thousands of kids, young people who and their wives and their children who would have had to immediately flee the country because they would have lost their visa. And we would have had employers who would have had to fire these thousands of kids. And so nobody wanted to cause that kind of disruption. They would want a sort of gradual, if a process like this was going to happen, it would have to be a gradual process so as to not impose that kind of tough result.
I understand why the district court did it, but if I find today, or if this court were to find today, that the district court didn't have jurisdiction to take that action, then there is no 2008 rule in effect, right? Because it's been vacated.
Well, you're right, Your Honor. The 2008 rule would have been vacated, would have been remanded, and a new rule would have had to happen. And if you're saying that at the time that the court remanded the proceeding, there was no jurisdiction to then extend the vacatur stay, which we think is incorrect, Your Honor. We think that's just part of any sort of order that the court has. The court can grant relief from its timing of its order. But having said that, Your Honor, as a functional matter, I don't know if this is the case to decide that, given that in 6 days we will have a new rule anyway, where all of this will be moot anyway. But it is an important point, but one that perhaps isn't necessary to decide here, given that we'll have the new rule and there won't have been a vacating of the 2008 rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, quickly, my wish list and for the court is that you put out a ruling that says that people on student visas have to be students, remand back to the district court. As far as this later rule, we can amend the complaint under Rule 15 under the Rules of Civil Procedure as a later action and add this later rule as part of an amended complaint. If you decide that there isn't jurisdiction, we pray that you will say or put out an order that says what has to be done to make this a final rule. And just quickly,
would you even want that by the time that happens and you file an amended complaint? If that were what were to happen, 2008 is going to be gone. I would think you'd want to focus your lasers on 2016 rule. Am I wrong about? Is there something about 2008 you really want to challenge that you can't get through the 2016? That
we
I'm
want,
missing?
Your Honor, we want the would like you to say the policy of allowing aliens to work on student visas when they're not students is unlawful.
So your position is the 2016 rule does not qualify as a reopener.
It could as well, Your Honor. It fits.
Then you could do that there. I'm trying to figure out if there's something you need in 2008 that you can't argue with respect to 2016.
Well, Your Honor, the district court has already decided that DHS does have this power. So we're going back to ask the district court to make a decision on what it's already decided.
Well, then maybe you would want us to rule that this case is moot and vacate the district court's decision. But I haven't heard that argument from you.
I haven't thought through that possibility that you're throwing out, Your Honor. But we would like an order that states from the court that says you have to be a student to be on a student visa. And quickly, in regard to standing, the rule is that under LA, Louisiana Energy, that allowance of competition is the injury, and that private conduct that is traceable to an action that is allowed by agency action is an injury. I also point out, just right quickly, that the reason this was limited to STEM is because they declared there's a labor shortage in STEM. It had absolutely nothing to do with educational needs at all. And I would conclude is that this...
You can keep going.
I can keep going.
Give you a minute.
And I also point that the statute for student visa status says solely for purpose of study at an approved academic institution. That would say that's the only thing. A tourist visa says that you're being admitted not for work, but under the district court's interpretation that those are only entry requirements. You can come here on a tourist visa and not for the purpose of work, and then DHS can allow you to work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted.